Okay, this talk's entitled For the Sake of Enlightenment, and it's an introduction and a few pointers to do with these texts that we've taken upon ourselves. And we'll be followed each of the next few mornings. We've got Moga Vajra, we've got Dasani, we've got Gunasiddhi going through, and tonight we've got Dana Badri. She'll be talking about her going forth into the mountains of Spain. So that'll keep us busy. Keep us engaged, keep us thinking. So these are, they're called the Terigata and the Teragata. Tera is a male elder and Teri is a female elder. A collection of verses attributed to these, the first people who followed the Buddha and the first few generations that followed them, right up until there's a sort of legends around these stories, these poems, and Ashoka's brother is supposed to be one of them. So that's like 200 years after the life of the Buddha. So it's a period, the first crucial generations of who the Buddha taught and who they passed it on to and who they taught, that basically we've got Buddhism because of these people. All our favourites are there. There's names. The verses, the single verses or collected verses, have got people's names attributed to them. Some, we know nothing about these names apart from the verses, the attachment to the verses. And some look suspiciously like they're just named after what's going on in the story, like somebody that lives in a hut, so he's called Kuta something, Viharin or something. There's others that are our favourites: Ananda, Aniruddha, Dhammadina, Sariputta, Kisha Gotami, Mahaprajapati, the Buddha's aunt. So all these names we're familiar with from a lot of the stories. They turn up here and they have their verses. Quite short collections. There's 522 verses in the Terigata and 1,279 in the Teragata, and they're bunched. They go up in numbers, so you start with just these little pithy, you know, one verse teachings and utterances, and they work up until you get 30, 40, 50, 60 verses at a time. And at the end of each of the two, the Teragata and the Terigata, you get these splendid great chapters, the Sumedhas. We'll come to her in a bit. I'll mention her quite a bit in this story, but in this talk is a sort of her declaration. It's got a big piece of drama. And then there's Vangisa in the men's collection, a beautiful poetry. He's the legendary poet. He was foremost of the Buddha's disciples for the ability to turn out good verse. The Buddha sort of rated him for that. There's lots of things going on. There's a When they get bigger, you get dialogues, you get somebody having a debate and winning, of course, against Mara, the personification of doubt. You've got a lovely story between, Gunasiddhi's going to go into this, between a nun and a seducer who stands in her way and just falls in love with her eyes, and she does him in. There's a guy who's going to get sacrificed by bandits, I'll come back to him. There's drama around that. So the collections, the stuff that's around is... There's K.R. Norman. This is Pali Text Society books. He's matter of fact. He seems more interested in the language. He's like, he's studying Pali rather than studying Buddhism sometimes, I feel. But it's very to the point. It's very kind of accurate. As good as you can get as a translation for accuracy. Here's one. This is the monks, Teras, the nuns, the sisters. You've got K.R. Norman in here and the magnificent Mrs. Caroline Rhys-Davids, her translation. And she just loves, she's Palgrave's golden treasury, isn't she? She's just a ornate language and flowery and rich, and she puts the stories in with it. There's a commentary that goes with these verses, and they're kind of made up after the time, in a way. They're after the stories, but so you think they're kind of, as it were, kind of made up after the fact, but they're so good that I think we can just let down our kind of high principles and our high standards of accuracy, and just like, these are too good a story to miss out. So she puts the stories in. She has her richer, more flowery translations. She's also done one. This one's the Teris, the Bhikkhunis, the nuns. There's also one of the, I think it's a three-volume one of the monks, which has got the stories. I haven't managed to find that. So I've been kind of working in the dark with the story side of it for the men. But the women's one, you've got lots of copies of it. The stories are taught, they fill in extra bits. Like our story about Kisha Gotami, our dead child, that comes from that. We've got, there's a lot more recently has been written about the women elders because of modern academic feminist studies and modern Buddhist women looking for a female voice, looking for Buddhism and a woman's voice, a woman's experience in that. And for that reason, if you go and get Google out and start looking up, you'll find lots to do with the Teres. And you have to dig a bit more to get the Teras, to get the men. And it's quite valuable, the Terigatas, the collection of the women's verses. It's a unique record of a community of women practitioners. You have to go hundreds of years until you get, I don't know, Hildegard of Bingen and St. Teresa of D'Avila and people like that. But they're solitary. This is a whole community of women practicing together, teaching each other, getting enlightened. It's quite unique. So, an elder, a venerated elder, is not simply old. Yeah? You don't get to be an elder by hanging around and putting in your time. Yeah? You're venerated for your attainments and your realizations. Yeah? Maturity is a human quality, isn't it? Of depth, insight, and experience. It's not like mature cheese. You know, it's not mature in that sense. You sit around the shelf and get tastier. Yeah? An elder in this sense is somebody who has realized, who's put in the work, who's got depth and maturity. In fact, some of these elders are, a couple of them are just 7 when they get enlightened. So it's not to do with age at all, has it? And these verses, they're songs of enlightenment. Yeah, the songs spoken by those who've realised the goal of nirvana that the Buddha set to them. They've got on with it, they've realised, and they've uttered these verses as they're kind of, this is what it's like, this is what I've realised. The big suttas in the Pali Canon, you get the advice of the Buddha. Somebody comes as a teaching. You get stories, you get experience of the Buddha. But in these, what you've got in particular is the experience of those who followed the Buddha's advice. Yeah? You get impermanence here as a lived experience in somebody's own body. So there's a courtesan, a former courtesan called Amba Pali. Now, a courtesan in ancient India is not a guilty, sordid deal around the back of a bus shelter. Yeah? It's... These are the movie stars of the time. Yeah, these are the people that would appear on the front cover, the celebrities that would appear on the front cover of Hello magazine. These are Amba Pali would command a fortune. Yeah, all the rich and famous would attend to her. Yeah, and seek her favours. And her song is about her growing old, and it's experience of impermanence from the inside. There's several verses on her hair. And in Asian culture generally, a woman's hair is this real sign of beauty. And she just says over and over again, verse after verse, on her hair. Black was my hair, the colour of bees and curled at the tips. With age it looked like coarse hemp. The truth of a truth speaker's words doesn't change. Adorned with gold and delicate pins, it was splendid, ornamented with braids. Now with age, that head has gone bald. The truth of a truth speaker's words doesn't change. Radiant, brilliant like jewels, my eyes. With age, they're no longer splendid. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. And she does this, like what it was like before, or it's like now, with her teeth, her voice, her neck, her skin, arms, thighs, legs. Her nose now is like a long pepper. Hands are now like onions and tubers. Breasts now dangle like empty old water bags. Very visceral, very graphic, yeah. Such was this physical heap, now a house with its plaster all fallen off. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. The men's verses, this is like, was it men from Mars, women from Venus? The men's verses tend to get the same realization, seeing the bodies of others. It's just the way we are. Yeah. You find out who you are, how it works, and you get on with it. Yeah. The women, it's like it's her body, and the men, it's like, oh my God, they grow old and they die. And it's that's their insight. Well, there is one where a bhikkhu sort of just realises, how did this come about? I remember my body being different. Where did this come from? That's his insight. Just so it's from the inside as well. But the others are like seeing corpses and. Yeah. So impermanence here doesn't lie in a book or a theory or in metaphysics. It's in the mirror. So these poems are the records of the forest renunciant wing of the Buddhist Sangha. Yeah. you have different lifestyles or approaches to the Buddhist practice at the time of the Buddha, the Buddha's disciples. You know, there was Anattapindika, a rich merchant whose name actually means the rice basket of those without anything. You just give. You know. And he was a householder and he gave. That was his practice. And these are the hardcore. These are the ones who got up, left everything, and went into the forest, followed the Buddha. And it's a tradition that goes from these people right down through the whole history of Buddhism. It's kind of quieter than other tradition, other aspects of Buddhism, but it's there. You've got Milarepa, he's famous, yeah, living in this forest, this mountain actually, away up in the caves, in the snow, meditating. Machik Labdrung, she who visualised chopping her body up and giving it to all the demons. Yeah. Han Shanch in China, living in cold mountain cave, all his beautiful Zen poetry. And their old favourite, Ryokan, very recent, living at the time of Burns in Japan. You've got it today in the Thai forest monks who revived this tradition in Theravada. It died out entirely. And they got back to it and said, right, let's get back to all this. What's it about? Get into the forest, practice, get on with it. Tibetans still do. Me and Dasani were up in a place called Sopema, it's at Parmasalva's pilgrimage site, his lake. And right up in the mountain, up in the rocks up above it, it's in the foothills of the Himalayas, right up in the rocks and the hills above it, there's like a village. You expect this kind of romantic caves in the middle of nowhere, but it's this kind of, well, it's India because it's a real rammy, everything's going on. And they're all kind of got their little huts and little doors and little homemade shelters, and they're getting on with their practice. There's one guy we met who wanted a photo, really took to Dasani and wanted a photograph with Dasani, which he had to both stand in this cardboard box for some reason. I'm taking the photograph. But he's up there for 3 years just practicing away, yeah. And then he's coming down below is the monastery where people are interacting with the public, interacting with the rest of the world. Bhante's teachers, yeah. Delgo Kensi spending over 20 years in retreat, a man with children, a family with big responsibilities, somehow managed to squeeze into a busy life. I think 27 I heard, it was over 20 anyway, years in solitary retreat. Chatral Rinpoche, yeah, his hardest of hardcore teachers. His phrase, we abide nowhere, we possess nothing. Chatral means something like beggar or having abandoned all mundane activities. And he lived like a beggar in Tibet. People would get, he was really esteemed as a teacher, and people would give him robes and jewels and all sorts of things, and they'd get up in the morning and he'd be gone and the jewels would be left lying there. Or they'd find a beggar out in the street wearing all these big fancy robes, and he'd swap for the old tatty robes and gone. He took a vow never to ride on a horse and never to enter a domestic building, you know, all the time he was in Tibet. And Bhante himself, you know, when he went forth, that period in his life in India, he burnt his passport, got rid of his clothes, got old pieces of rag and just stained them in the earth, and then walked out into, and just relied on people to feed him. He would stand with a bowl, and whatever was put in his bowl, that's what he'd eat. And for several years he lived in various ways, but very simple life, walking to the bottom, back to the top of India. And we've got modest beginnings in the Theravada Buddhist movement as well. Bodhidaka, that we used to work and live here, he's up in Guhyaloka meditating away up there for, is it over a year now? Sachinama, a friend of mine, he's heading to join him. We had Varadakini and a friend up in the Bothy for 3 years practicing away up there. So it's a meditative life. Yeah, it looks uneventful from the outside. Somebody sitting in a hut meditating, it's like, it's not going to make good soap opera, is it? But what's going on the inside is really rich, you know? Whole focus is on meditation and wisdom, and that gives a spareness to these texts. It gives a directness and a simplicity. This tradition, there's no messing about, there's no ornateness, there's no round about the houses. It's boom. Yeah. So if you read these things, you'll get that. If you're receptive enough, you'll get that boom, directness. Yeah. They cast away lots of the stuff that we think is essential. Here's a verse. I sleep the whole night, delighting in company by day. When will the fool bring suffering and stress to an end? And there's great struggles in the poems, yeah? And there's great joys in the bliss of practice. Just as a fine thoroughbred steed with swishing tail and mane runs with next to no effort, so my days and nights run with next to no effort, now that I've gained a happiness not of the flesh. And then, like all of those, Milarepa, Hanshan, Ryokan, the whole tradition, they just they sing about the beauty of the world around them, this forest that they've entered. When a thundering storm cloud roars out in the mist, and torrents of rain fill the paths of the birds, nestled in a mountain cave, the monk meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When along the rivers the tumbling flowers bloom, and winding wreaths adorned with verdant colour, seated on the bank, glad-minded, he meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When in the depths of night, in a lonely forest, the rain deva drizzles and the fangled beasts cry. Nestled in a mountain cave, the monk meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. And then Chitika's verse. Peacocks, crested, blue, with gorgeous necks, cry out in the Karamvi woods, thrilled by the cold wind. They awaken the sleeper to meditate. And they tell of the enjoyment of the simple life, the several verses on their huts, their little huts they live in. My hut is roofed, comfortable, free of drafts, my mind well-centered, set free. I remain ardent. So, Rain Deva, go ahead and rain. It's part of the Kudaka Nikaya, a collection of little texts, part of the Pali Canon, the body of teachings from the earliest big collections of Buddhist teachings that were preserved in Sri Lanka. Yeah. And there's a little bundle in this collection of little texts that are, they seem to all come from this tradition. They're very direct, very simple, and very to the point. Dhammapada, Suttanapatta, Yodana, the Itta-Buttika, that's kind of the big six, these two, the Teras and the Teris, and these four. Big six in this collection. And you'll find in these verses, you know, if you're familiar with the Dhammapada, a whole verse pops up straight from the Dhammapada. It shares some verses with it. So it's straight talking, it's hard hitting, brief to the point. It's a bit like going a brisk walk on a clear day, and it's for the same purpose. It's to clear your head, it's to get the cobwebs out, stir you up, wake you from your doziness. In a way, that's what they're for. Yeah. And it's serious practice. You know, these people are not five-a-side with a pint with your mates afterwards. You know. They're, I've been getting these footballers' names from Alistair, so I'm going to pronounce them wrong. Iniesta? Yeah. Javis, what's his name? Xavi, yeah. And Ronaldo, yeah. It's that level of practice. Yeah, it's not kicking the ball around, you know. It's like top rank. So be warned, yeah. We're dipping into some of life's truths when we get into these verses. And our job this week or this weekend is to integrate our lives a bit more with these truths. Yeah. It's to let our experience catch up just a little bit by exposing ourselves to the experience of these people, of these venerated elders. Yeah. Our task is to see reality that bit more clearly with their help. So why are we on this retreat? We've got the food, we've got the scenery, we've got the companionship. Yeah, it's all very good, but it doesn't get to the hub of it, isn't it? It's not why we've come. Yeah. Why do Buddhists do what they do? Why do we live ethically? Why do we give, work, care, meditate, study, reflect, support each other in the Sangha? Yeah. We get all used to it, don't we? We get used to it and go, well, this and that, that's Buddhism. Yeah, and this and that, that's the Buddhist view. You know, we've got this range of different little compartments. This is the Christian view, this is the secular view, this is the Buddhist view, it's all right, that's that sorted. Yeah. But it's not an end in itself. Yeah. Buddhist activities have a goal, they've got an ultimate purpose. All dharmas lead to the one goal. That's one of Atisha's phrases. All dharma practice is going for refuge to the three jewels. Right. Number one, go for refuge to the awakened human being, the enlightened mind. And two, we go for refuge to the vision of that awakened human being. And three, we go for refuge to the community or the communication between enlightened beings. That's the goal. Yeah. Bodhi, Nibbana, enlightenment. I'm going to go into these now. I'm going to go into what this enlightenment is. It's Lokuttara. This word Lakutra, which means, the word that gets translated as transcendental, which is all sorts of complications in English language, but For me, is it transcends the threefold world. It transcends the world of the senses. You know? Whatever we can perceive, whatever we can discern with the eye, with our ears, with our nose, with our tongue, right? With our body, whatever we conceive of with our mind, this mind that we have at present. Yeah. Enlightenment is not defined, not containable in that. It's not containable in the depth of meditation. It's not containable in the world of pure form, in the world of sort of visionary colour and visionary ecstasy, almost, sort of the dhyanic states. Yeah? When you've left the sensory world to enter into deeper meditation, the depths of that, you won't find enlightenment. And it's not contained in the world of even deeper meditation. To get anywhere near this level of meditation, I think you have to speak to Prasada or something. When he starts talking about his meditation, you think, all right, he's in the formless realms. Where even formless realms, where even the pure form, the archetypal level of practice doesn't have any relevance. Enlightenment's not contained within that. It's not definable or expressible in any of these terms, any of these frameworks. In the elders' verses, you've got classic references, classic ways of describing enlightenment, and they say it over and over again. So you've got the extinction of the ashravas, you've got the destruction of the fetters, you've got the attainment of the threefold knowledge. So I better go into these one at a time. Ashravas, that's one of these annoying Buddhist words that you can't get an easy translation for. You have to come up with half a dozen words in English. Cankers, biases, Tanisaro and access to insight. He's got fermentations, which makes you think. Yeah. Basically, the deep forces that distort or bias our experience. Yeah. They prevent us from seeing things as they actually are. And there's three of those. There's the bias of sense desire. That distorts how things are, how our ability to perceive it. There's the bias for continued existence, of wanting to stay the same or stay anything. Yeah. And then the bias of spiritual ignorance. And they're not just like ordinary psychological level notions. They're really deep, really rooted at the heart of what holds us apart from being awakened. The 10 fetters are broken. Oh, I've listed all these. I could go into if you want, but let's skip that. You know, the first three, that's enough to get on with. The threefold knowledge, it's what in the Buddha's biography, it's a night of his enlightenment. He saw through three phases of going deeper and deeper into just breaking the bonds and seeing directly. And this is these Teris and Teras, these elders, often describe this. This is the way they would explain the threefold knowledge. First of all is the knowledge of previous abodes. You just open up from fixed in this moment to seeing not just a whole of your life, but lifetimes. There's one, I think a Bhikkhuni, a nun, is describing that night I stayed ardent with my practice and saw far back in my life as far as 500 aeons. And an aeon in Buddhism is a silly big number, it's enormous. Knowledge of the passing away and re-arising of living beings. You break beyond your own envelope and you just like see all beings, they are rising and falling away, now happy, now suffering, yeah, now successful, now failing. It's the rising and falling of every single living being. And then finally, in the third watch of the Buddha's night under the Bodhi tree, knowledge of the ending of the ashravas, these biases. He breaks them, he knows he breaks them. So this is what the main event in these texts, yeah. This is the central point, the central theme, attainment of enlightenment. It's why they were written, or they were spoken and memorized, and why they were passed down and held precious and held like alive all these for over 2,000 years. The disciples of the Buddha attained what he had realized himself. Hearing the well-spoken words of the awakened one, kinsman of the sun, I pierced what is subtle, as if with an arrow, the tip of a horse-tail hair. Puna, grow full with good qualities, like the moon on the 15th day, with discernment at total fullness, burst the mass of darkness. The five heaps having been comprehended, stand with their root cut through. For me, the ending of suffering is reached, the ending of the biases attained. And this is the focus, this awakening is the focus of the whole of Buddhism. Yeah? It's why we're here. Yeah? If it's not going for refuge to the Buddha, it's not Buddhism, it's not the Dharma. I was starting to write this article when I was on retreat down at Padmaloka a couple of weeks ago, and I was showing some of my little notes to Ross, and then during the silence he sort of handed me a slip which said, have a look at Tanisaro's article on Access to Insight. So it's a website, Access to Insight, which Tanisaro's an American Theravadan bhikkhu, and it's got loads, if you haven't found it yet, it's got so much of the Pali Canon and essays and talks and ways into it. And this article that Ross wanted me to look at is Samvega and Pasada. So I thought, once I'd read it, I thought, this will do. So this is the main structure of my talk, the main bit of it. The actual essay is Affirming the Truths of the Heart, the Buddhist Teachings on Samvega and Pasada. So thank you, Ross. Samvega, that's another word that takes a bit of explaining. Another good Buddhist word that takes a small dictionary. It's what arose in the Buddha when he saw the first three sights. Remember, he goes out into the streets of Kapilavastu. He sees an old person, a sick person, and a dead person. And life's not the same again, is it? Yeah. Tanisaro gives a detailed description of the three aspects of this emotion, the complexity of it. So one, the oppressive sense of shock, dismay and alienation that come with realising the futility and meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived. Secondly, a chastening sense of our own complacency and foolishness in having let ourselves live so blindly. I don't know if you get this, but that's that 3 o'clock in the morning feeling. You wake up and it's like, what the hell are you doing? You're just living your life kind of like that kind of pace, and so you wake up in like that raw moment and go, could do better, isn't it? That's the report card, that raw sense. And then thirdly, an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle. So it's shock, dismay and alienation when you realise that life as it's lived is futile, because you've seen how it ends, you've seen that it's not in your control. Yeah, and you get that sense of, oh my God, what am I doing with it? And then you get this sense of, there must be a way, I have to get out of this. This is just going on. And this was the Buddha's spur, yeah, to leave his limited worldly life. He needed something else that I'll come back to. But this is a spur that gets him going. Yeah. Life as it's normally lived, as he was normally living it, could not be lived anymore. He sees all these people in the village, in the streets. And he sees that he's just the same. It's that empathy. As they are, so am I. So is my family. So are all the people I know. We'll all grow old. We'll all be sick. We'll all die. And the elders felt it. The last section in the Teri Gathas, the female elders, is Sumedha. And she's the daughter of a king. A really rich king, of course, as these stories have. Imagine a fairy's tale, right? She's in the palace and she has beautiful family and beautiful possessions. And they're going to marry her off to another king who's even better off. Yeah? And the king comes all the way. And, well, in a fairy tale and in ancient India, you don't go on your own. You come with elephants and parasols and attendants. And it's like, proceeding forward to claim his bride. And then, of course, the old father's cunning. He's thinking, well, that'll be too kingdoms combined, and that means I'll be able to get back at them. Yeah, that's all going on, but the Sumedha's not having any of it. She's wanting out of it, and she's standing behind the door of her room, and her parents and the would-be grooms on the other side pleading, and she comes out with some of the most devastating stuff in Buddhism. She refuses the fairy tale wedding, basically. Yeah. It's not got a happy ending in that level. Remember the tears, the milk, the blood, the journeying on as being without beginning and end. Remember the heap of bones of beings who are journeying on. When the unaging exists, what do you want with sensual pleasures in which are old age and death? All births everywhere are bound up with death and sickness. And it's the groom who just turns to the parents and goes, we should just let her go. So credit to him. And he gets his elephants and his attendants and his parasol and dejectedly just goes back to his glorious kingdom. And she's off, cuts off her hair, you know, this Asian woman's hair, and heads to the forest. And the elders all reach this point in various ways. Yeah, there's not just one way. There's pain and loss. Yeah. The story of Kisha Goti with her dead child, her madness, you know, not accepting the death of the child. Yeah. There's Isi Dasi, and she's rejected by one husband after another in the story. She did all her best efforts, all her attempts to fit in with the in-laws and with the husband, and after a month, they just go off her. And this goes on and on and on. Yeah. Patacharas, this is like, this outdoes it all. In 24 hours, managed to lose her husband from snake bite, both children from a hawk and a river, and parents and brother and entire family that she comes from to a flood that demolishes the house. Yeah. It outdoes a country and western scale of tragedy. I've been in a right country and western mood. I've been listening to Stanley Brothers and Johnny Cash and Hank Williams and Bluegrass. There's all these old verses that go way back to border ballads, you know. The border ballad of the cruel sister, you know, it's like, it's all quite tragic, it's all it's heavy stuff. And these songs, when they sing about digging a hole, they're not going gardening. I'm digging a hole. Yeah, it's like, well, you know, that they're going to be in it, or they're going to put somebody in it, or it's going to go wrong. Yeah. But these tales of Patachara and her friends, outdoes it. Yeah, outdoes the gloomiest country and western song. But there's other elders that come to the Dharma out of a successful life. Yeah? We've got Sumedha there, yeah, refusing her fairy tale wedding. She's top of the tree. You don't get any more successful than where she is. Daughter of a king, about to marry an even bigger king. Beautiful. Yeah. There's Yasha, yeah, one of the Buddha's first disciples. This playboy who wakes up in the middle of the night in his palace and sees... Well, he sees through what for most people would be the lottery fantasy. Yeah. Everyone's all fallen asleep. The dancing girls, the female attendants, the musicians. And he just sees them all there, lolling and sagging and slavering in their sleep. Yeah, just lying around. And he just goes, this is awful. And he runs out of the palace. I am oppressed. I am distraught. This is a Samvega. And he's got his golden slippers on and his ornaments and his beautiful jewels. And he's wandering through the forest going, I am oppressed. I am oppressed. This is awful. You know, what would I do? And the Buddha's sitting in the middle of the forest saying, this is not oppressive. And he just attends to him. And this is annoying, isn't it? It's really easy. This is his verse. Well anointed with all the ornaments and perfume. Well dressed, adorned with all my ornaments, I attained the three knowledges. The Buddha's teaching has been done. Just like that. Just like that. Quite annoying. But Sumedha and Yasha, they're not spoiled brats. Yeah? You read the stories of people like this, they're like, they're well brought up youths, they're ethical, they're kind, they're generous, they're just like perfect beings, but it's not enough. Yeah? The happiest life they can get, they have got, is unbearably restricting, it's unsatisfactory, and they have to search for something else. They have to go beyond that. And it's important to see this as well, not just to see that we take the Dharma as a way out of disaster, as a way out of failure, as a way out of loss or illness. It's also, we can respond to it just as validly out of success, out of well-being. We can see through the limitations of life in any aspect of life, any way of experiencing it. Otherwise, we miss the Buddha's teachings on suffering, miss the Buddha's teachings on dukkha, and see it just as straightforward pain. We don't see that it goes much further than that. Yeah. And our Buddhism just becomes an attempt to fix our life at our own level. Yeah. Just to try to use the Dharma to move from worldly failure to worldly success. From worldly misery to worldly happiness. Where that Dharma's taking you is beyond a whole lot. This world, yeah, all these things in it, yeah, whether we find it painful, whether we find them pleasant, is characterised by three marks. This is as basic as Buddhism gets. This is without this, in a way, you don't really have Buddhism. Just as sugar is sweet and fire is hot. It's a lovely phrase from Nagarjuna. Yeah. Sugar, it's always sweet. Fire, it's always hot. Yeah. All things are always impermanent. All things are always without substantial entity, substantial reality. And all things are unsatisfactory. This word dukkha, unsatisfactory, pain, stress, all these translations you get from it. It's another one of these Buddhist words that's got many translations. Try this. This is a way of looking at three levels of dukkha. This covers it all. One, straightforward failure, downright pain. Two, success for the moment, but you know it won't last. You've managed to get to a certain point, that's good, but you know it won't last. And that is expressed and felt as stress and anxiety. And then success, as good as it will ever get. And that is expressed as unsatisfactory, it's experienced as unsatisfactory. And this latter, we tend to ignore in modern Buddhism. You don't have it in our culture. I was thinking of trying to get a contemporary equivalent, and it's sort of just really unlikely. You imagine Barack Obama, he gets into the White House, he spends a few months there, and then stands out in the front of his microphones pointing up and goes, "I'm giving this up. This is not the best way to help people." And he walks out of the White House. He walks out of politics. Or the chief exec that hands his bonus back goes, "This isn't it, is it?" Gives it back. Or the Spanish footballer, the morning after winning the World Cup, just sitting there realising, "Oh, we did it. But is that it? What now?" You don't get beyond that in football, do you? Won the World Cup. What now? What next? That is not enough. In our own lives, yeah? Not just famous people, but our own lives, it's a matter of seeing that our present life is just not fixable on its own level. Yeah? All our therapies, all our self-helps. Yeah? We can have our inner demons all well-fed and content. Our relationships are well-attuned. We know that men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Our pain, our stress and depression is all well managed. And yoga and tai chi and eating and everything, we're so healthy, we glow. Yeah, we're so fit, we glow. But it still doesn't fix the niggling dissatisfaction. It still won't cover the ground. Yeah. And then there's another characteristic mark of things. All things are without substance. Yeah. All things are without ultimate graspable meaning. There's a story, the story of Adi Mutta, who gets captured by the bandits, and they're going to sacrifice him. This is like Kali worship, you know, Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom, they sacrifice people to Kali. This actually went on, not so dramatically, not with Indiana Jones to rescue anybody, but human sacrifice went on. And they're going to do this guy in, but he's so calm and he's so collected, they go, "What's going on? Why are you're supposed to be scared? You know, why are you sitting there so calmly?" And he says, "Having attained the supreme rightness, unconcerned with all the world, as if released from a burning house, he doesn't sorrow at death. Whatever's compounded, whatever a state of becoming's obtained, all that has no one in charge. So says the great seer. Whoever discerns this, as taught by the awakened one, would no more grasp hold of any state of becoming than he would a hot iron ball. I have no I was, no I will be. Fabrications will simply go out of existence. What's to lament there and that? For one who sees as it actually is, the pure arising of phenomena, the pure seriality of fabrications, there's no fear. When seeing the world with discernment, as on a par with grass and twigs, finding no mindness, thinking, there's nothing of mine, he feels no sorrow. Do as you like with this carcass. From what I will feel, neither hatred nor love." And they're so impressed with this, they throw their weapons away and join him. They get their heads shaven and they get their old robes out of the dust heap and they become bhikkhus. So that's a fairy story with a happy ending. So birth, aging, death are meaningless. Yeah? Ultimately without graspable significance. This beautiful landscape that we enjoy, yeah? We look at, that rewards us. We can just calm down and be in the mud stop. Ultimately, no meaning. It's so other in a way that we just bring whatever we want to. Yeah? We've got Coleridge and Wordsworth. They've taught us how to go, meaning. Yeah? They lost God, so they put a hell in the place. Yeah? But if you were to get lost out in it, yeah, seriously lost, in the dark, cold, hungry, how long before you never want to see a hill again? Or you had to get your job out of it, you had to get your work out of it, like Wan over in Tuareg or the McNaughtons up in Inverlochlarig. Can you imagine trying to gather sheep off that hill? I used to think Arn was big, but they're tiny little soft hills. The stuff they try and get up the top there, get the sheep down, and get them through that forest, yeah, over and over again. Our body, our everyday mind, our relationships, society, countries, our culture, our religions, Buddhist practice as an end in itself, are all ultimately meaningless. They're not ultimate refuges. They're not an answer to some vaguer or urgent sense of futility. If you look at history, you see a world out of control. A Buddhist perspective on history sees it as that. It's without order. There's random lunges from here to there and back again. And there's nobody in charge. There ain't no Santa Claus. There's no progress, ultimately, in history. There's no happy ending. There's no glorious day when it all gets sorted out. There's no ending at all. It just goes on and on and on. A ceaseless round. Yeah? Now happy, now disastrous. Now successful, now failure. This is samsara. This is the wheel of life. It's like a wheel round the wheel of life. It's not a line going from we start here and we end there. And this is what a non-theistic world looks like. Nobody in charge, no great ending, the world goes on. And Buddhists, of course, are non-theistic. As Alan Moore, the graphic novelist, writes, the world is rudderless. We all think somewhere there's a rudder. If we can just find it and get in charge, we can steer this to where we want to be, and that's it, sorted. We can sort out the environment and the world and the politics and the labour rights and all the things, but you never find a rudder. Pleasure and pain come and go. Beauty and ugliness come and go without ultimate significance. Our experience is transient, elusive. Our body, mindfulness of our body, it doesn't, mindfulness of the body practice doesn't enable us to get it sorted and this is it, this is me. What it does is opens up and we see that it's ungraspable, it's transient, it's unsatisfactory. Yeah. That's what mindfulness of body practice leads us to. Mentally, it just keeps moving through our head, doesn't it? We can't fix things. We want to get it clear, we want to get it sorted, we want to get this system, we'll be able to understand everything, and it goes. It constantly changes. Ideas come and go. Nothing quite gives us the conceptual framework to sort it. Yeah. Emotionally, yeah, we're all over the place. Yeah. Watching the kids this morning, one minute they're crying their eyes out, next minute they're laughing in delight, you know. And we've grown up, so we're a bit slower, but we're no different. Yeah. We're just totally susceptible to whatever happens around us. Things change, and we're way over here. We're way over there. There's no solid ground. We see the lack of solid ground and we're uneasy. And we reach out to things, to success, to career, to people. We grasp at love affairs, families, friends. The thing is, they're exactly in the same boat. Everybody else is just where we were, just as unanchored. You won't find it there either. And it's not a glib, easy matter. Yeah, it's not, yes, all things are impermanent without substance. That's insulting to human experience, to human suffering, isn't it? What we're talking about is our identity, yeah, this habitual, instinctual grasping. It's sense pleasure, it's security. What we've built ourselves upon. Everything that we hold to heart, everything we stand on, we cling to that. It's something really deep. It reminds me when I was a youth hunting for rats in the barn. So we go out at night with a torch, and I had Lucky, who was half Jack Russell and half Collie, which is a rather odd looking mixture, but She had enough Jack Russell blood to be really good at getting rats. Straight in, grab the rat, shake it, and gurry it, as you call it. And a dead rat. Yeah. And the rats didn't like this. Yeah, so they're desperately running for any cover. And we've tried the best we can to shut off any real escape. And so they go under a tin, or under a bag, or under a pot, and you pick it up, and lucky's at them again. Yeah. I wouldn't do that now. But they were desperate, this desperate urge for security, safety, to get away from it. And this is what, this has struck me as like, this is what life feels like. Yeah? I get back from the Bodhi Sattva ideal, you know, altruism and early gardening at Pamaloka, and as I notice saying, I have to leave my flat. You know, and I'm going, but I love it here. I was actually crying, I was like, I'm so moved. But I really like living here with Dastney in this space, and it's all going. And thinking, death is like this without an eviction letter. I mean, you might have a proper diagnosis from a doctor that gives you have 4 months, you must be vacating the premises in 4 months. But it's less certain, but it's no different. You know? Things just disperse, go apart, and your heart's in it. You know? It's not a glib matter. We're desperately looking for safe escapes, you know? And lucky is the big demon of impermanence looking in over the rim, ready for another bite, yeah, ready for another munch, another gurry. Yeah. And then the Buddha's there, isn't he? The Buddha and these elders are telling us it's not satisfactory, it's without significant substance. No wonder it rattles us. Sometimes we even hate it. It just annoys us, it's getting in the way. Why can't I just do this, enjoy this, and just go away and leave me alone, you know? The thing is, there's something in us that sees it's true. Something in us that can't ignore it. Something in us that can't dismiss it. Most people in the world do dismiss it. Most people will go, Buddhism, yeah, that's quite nice, but there you go. It's the very peaceful people. Yeah, leave it at that. Yeah. But it's got under our skin, and we can't ignore it. There's a part of us, the most honest, the most aware part of us, that knows it to be true. And the elders, the men and women elders, they are responding to that honest part, to that part that knows that. Rossi's recommendation, his other part of that essay, was Pasada. We know the man called Pasada. And he's called that because the meaning of the word is clarity, serene confidence, and faith. One of those words we shy away from in our Western secular world. But there it is. Serene confidence, heart placed serenely, and not blindly, but aware with clarity. There's loads of other meanings to Pasada, but this is in this context. The Buddha has a fourth sight. Luckily, all I've been describing can be quite grim, and it's a bit of a grim end unless you get the fourth sight. The Buddha sees, walking through Kapilavastu, a forest meditator. Calm, contained, focused and mindful. Walking through like the hubbub, just the madness of a normal city life. People buying and selling and arguing and chatting each other up, and this person's just going straight through the night. And he sees that and goes, that is the way out. This is my escape. And then he has to go through all the rigmarole of escaping from the palace and all that. But it's his confidence, his clarity of seeing that and making a move. As Tanisaro says, Pasada is what keeps Samvega from turning into despair. There's lots of people in the world who have too much of the first. We see sickness, we see death, we see futility, but we don't see the positive way of responding to it. You can't go forth without going for refuge. And you can't go for refuge without going forth. Basic, it's almost physics, isn't it? Some sort of, you can't let go of one thing without an alternative. You've got to go somewhere. The idea of letting go of something and staying put and nothing, that's hate, that's destroying yourself. Here's Sumedha again. When the unaging exists, what do you want with sensual pleasures, in which are old age and death? All births everywhere are bound up with death and sickness. This is unaging. This is dying. This is the unaging, undying state, without grieving, without enmity, unobstructed, without stumbling, without fear, without burning. This undying has been attained by many, and this is to be attained even today by one who rightly applies himself, but it cannot be attained by one who does not strive. So the Buddha had to discover for himself, in a way. He followed the example of the meditator. But the Teras and the Teris, the elders, had the advantage of following him. They met him. They could see that an alternative to despair could be lived successfully. There it was, in the flesh. A living example. Here was an example of what to do next. A whole bigger dimension to life had opened up. And they committed themselves, went for refuge to his teaching and to the goal that he'd attained. Here's a verse that appears lots of times. The teacher has been served by me, the awakened one's bidding done, the heavy load laid down, the guide to becoming, craving ended. And there's plenty of verses of praise and devotion to the Buddha. Here's one by his own aunt, Mahaprajapati. Buddha, hero, praise be to you, you foremost among all beings, you who have released me and so many others from pain. And then they, in turn, they become inspirations and guides to others. So we had Patachara, the woman who had the disastrous day with her entire family's wiped out. Well, later on, in the very next poem, she's a teacher and a preceptor to 30 others. And then she leads them to awakening. She gets them down. This is what you do. And by the morning time, they're all enlightened. And then there's a third poem after that, which is lovely. It's a more personal relationship. Yeah. This woman, Chanda, the beggar, who is begging just for scraps of food, just looking for something to eat, and lost everything, lost her entire family and everything, and then saw that Pathachara was doing it better and getting more food. So she goes and joins her. And then Parachara gets her to work and makes her meditate. So there's this thing from poverty to wanting to get quite mundane sides of Parachara, to realising there's a whole other dimension to what she's doing, to taking that on and then getting riches beyond measure, enlightenment. Before I had fallen in even evil times, no husband, no children, no relatives, friends, no way to obtain clothing and food. So taking a staff and bowl in hand, begging for alms from house to house, feverish from the cold and heat, I wandered for 7 full years. Then seeing a bhikkhuni obtaining food and drink, I approached her and said, let me go forth into homelessness. She, Patachara, from sympathy, let me go forth. Then, exhorting me, urged me on to the highest goal. Hearing her words, I did her bidding. Her exhortation was not in vain. I am a 3-knowledge woman, bias free. So it's a bit of a rags to rags story, isn't it? But, you know, it's to the riches of enlightenment. It's a different sense of progression. This is basically how Sangha works, isn't it? You become like those you spend your time with and that you pay attention to. Kisha Gotami. Resorting to noble friends, even a fool would be wise. Good people are to be resorted to. Thus the wisdom of those who resort to them increases. Resorting to good people, one would be released from all pains. So what do we do about it? And we all go and start building little huts. So if we're here for a week, we could get one going by Friday. And just abandon our commitments. Yeah? It would be quite excellent if more of us were in a position to do this, to go and join Smriti Ratna, not in his hut, but you know, round about in the wood. You'd probably not like that too much, but you know, and get on with practice, serious meditating. But some of us have responsibilities, don't we? We've got children, we've got aged parents to care for, we've got our jobs in the world, which for many of us are genuine vocations, you know, the ways that we work out our ideals, the ways we help people. So what practical hints can we take from these verses? How do we find what Dhammarati calls doables, yeah, things that we can do in these teachings? Things that we can get on with. This is crucial. Without, on the one hand, compromising the vision of the goal, yeah, by reducing it all down just to our current experience, yeah, just to how we are. The danger with saying things like, Buddhism is simply kindness and awareness, is that we tend to take it as just to being a wee bit more kind to the kids and the neighbours, and a wee bit more aware of, for some reason modern books are full of aware of laundry, aren't they? Aware of washing up. Modern popular books in Buddhism are very kind of like focused on that. Yeah. All things, these are good in themselves, but don't quite cover it. don't quite cover Buddhism. If we do that, if we take this approach, Buddhism can become, and the Buddha can become, just us in a good mood. Yeah. Our ordinary messy self, sanctified with a little watered down diet. I was thinking, did I take that nasty light out or leave it in? On the other hand, yeah, we see the Buddha as this unbelievably distant goal. Yeah. These elders are exalted, admirable, even worshipful. Yeah. But they're so exalted, but they're so beyond us, we can't even relate to them in our lives. They're not relevant to our actual life we're living. And there's nothing we can do in relation to these exalted ideals. We're just puny mortals. There's nothing we can do. Yeah. I think in a modern popular book of Buddhism is the example of the former error, then the kind of exotic Buddhism is the approach to this. You know, we kind of love the Dalai Lama, but we have no hope and no intention of becoming him. You know, he's got the job, we wouldn't get it. Yeah, there's only one Dalai Lama, he can't get the job. So it stays up there. That's lovely and spiritual, and these lovely robes, and we are just here. Yeah. Which is what the whole point's about, and those both these approaches are the safe way of staying the way we are. It's how we neutralise the Dharma. The Dharma comes into our life, it stirs us up, and we look for a way of staying the same. This fixing self has strategies to just stay just as we are and contain this new thing called the Dharma. And both these approaches are ways of doing that, bringing the Dharma down to just as we are, or seeing it so far away it's got nothing to do with us. But the Dharma is a threat. That's exactly what it is. Bhante talks about it being a live current of electricity. If you touch a live current, you get a shock. Jesus. Yeah. If you don't get a shock, it's not the Dharma. It's a threat to you as you are just now. Yeah. The Dharma is entirely designed to change you from you are just now. Yeah. Change you for the better. So I'm going to go through 3 points and round off my talk. We're looking at 3 points that rise up come in my reading of these verses. So you'll all have your own, you know, you'll be hearing those and thinking about those, and we've got our study groups to sort of go over them and share them. But here's mine that stand out for me. These are 3 things that I could do with reflecting on and putting more into practice. Wholeheartedness, practice is work, and freedom, bliss and beauty. These stand out from these verses for me. Have you all seen I Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash movie? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was a Johnny Cash movie that won an Oscar or something, but it's the life of Johnny Cash up to the time he gets the gal, gets June Carter, doesn't he? And there's a bit where he goes into Sun Records, it's his first edition, him and his little band that's been practicing in the backyard for months, and they've got this dreary little gospel tune that they're singing away. And Sam Phillips, the owner of Sun Records, he just goes, "Whoa, stop!" You know, and Johnny Cash says, "But you didn't let us bring it home." And he goes, "Here's it. I looked this up, this part of the screenplay. Bring it home? All right, let's bring it home. If you was hit by a truck and you were lying out in that gutter dying and you had time to sing one song, huh? One song people would remember before your dirt. One song that would let God know that you felt what you felt about your time here on earth. One song that would sum you up. You telling me that's the song you'd sing? That same Jimmy Davis tune we hear on the radio all day about your peace within and how it's real and how you're going to shout it. Or would you sing something different, something real, something you felt? Because I'm telling you right now, that's the kind of song people want to hear. That's the kind of song that truly saves people. It ain't got nothing to do with believing in God, Mr. Cash. It has to do with believing in yourself." Now, it's a bit hammed up Hollywood style, isn't it? But there's something in there, isn't there? Think. What is the one song that would sum you up? Mm-hmm. Something real, something you felt. What song sums you up? What's real for you? In the Zen tradition, what's your koan? Yeah. Not a nice little puzzle, but the big problem. Yeah? The conundrum. Yeah? The heart of the issue for you. And are you living it? Yeah? Like you only had a few minutes left, like you were lying in the dirt, hit with a truck. Here's Shiramanda. Make the day not in vain, whether a little or a lot of life is left. However much the day passes, that's how much less is life. Your last day approaches. This isn't the time to be heedless. So this is something deeper and more urgent than our likes and dislikes. Yeah? Our issue isn't a matter of style or life choice. It's not an option. It's deeper than our personality, our nationality, our gender, our preferences. It's not a matter of me going, can I have my big issue in black, please? And something to do with coming from Aaron. And, yeah, it's deeper than that. It's the inescapable theme of our being, which we'd probably rather not have. That's a good test to see whether it's an option or not. You don't want it. Yeah? You're a big problem. You don't like it necessarily. You don't want to identify with it necessarily. It's the big issue, the great matter. So what is it? What's yours? The elders each had their big issue. That's what comes out in each of these verses, these songs. Laziness, lust, devastating loss, intolerable success. Yeah, they couldn't get away with it. Yeah, they couldn't get away from it. Nirvana is the biggest issue of all. Yeah. It's the song that sums everything up. It's the realest issue. And each elder has taken their particular inescapable issue, their song, and taken it so deep it's become indistinguishable from the Nirvana song, from reality itself, from the song of enlightenment. Their song's become so true it reflects reality itself flawlessly. It's the way they become so themselves, they've become transparent. They've become, as it were, at one with the way things are. They're no longer themselves, they're no longer there, they're not identifiable in any sense you could apply to. So it's what we're doing right now, something we feel, yeah, that we'd be doing while lying in the dirt with our last minutes. It's how we meditate when we're in the shrine room. Is that how we meditate if we're in the last minutes in the dirt? Do we follow each breath as if it's our last? Yeah. How do we do our puja? Are we just going to intone half-mindedly, with Minerva, blue lotus and jasmine, with all flowers pleasing and fragrant? Or do we feel it? Yeah. Can we bring ourselves fully to feel it, our last puja? As much of you will get enlightened as is enlightened in your practice. Yeah. This being, that becomes. Everything arises and depends upon conditions. Enlightenment arises and depends upon practice. So we've got nice notions practice, it leads to a nice notion enlightenment. If we've got bits and pieces practice in our spare time, it leads to bits and pieces enlightenment. If we've got body, speech, heart and mind practice, it'll lead to complete enlightenment. It'll lead to what we chant in the Tiratnavandana, Sama Sambuddhasa, fully, perfectly awake. Secondly, practice as a place of work. So wholeheartedness, wholehearted attitude, wholehearted intention, motivation has to express itself in specific practices. Yeah. There's another point from another essay by Thanissaro Bhikkhu, which is quite a feature in this. He talks about, he's responding to meditation as just a kind of vague, loose openness. And he's saying, the Pali term for meditation is bhavana. These elders, when they're talking about meditation, is bhavana, development. Yeah. It's the deliberate development of skillful qualities in the mind. It's a type of karma, a type of intentional action. In this case, it's a positive karma. You intentionally set about to make something positive happen. You're working to create something positive. It's a creation of something good, something worthwhile. And this is what true work is, isn't it? It's the Buddhist term, artacharya. Yeah? The carrying out, the fading in, the living out of, the working of the good. Sometimes gets glibly translated as good deeds, which I think misses the point. So all work has three factors: systematic, sustained, successful. In our practice, we have to work systematically to get something done. In your job, you have to work systematically. You have to know what you're doing and do it thoroughly. Otherwise, your boss gets you into trouble. Art requires systematic training. Sport requires systematic training. Why should Buddhist practice be any different? The elders had theirs. The Buddha had a system of meditation. There's a meditation which was an antidote to a particular poison. So the monk comes along completely besotted about lust. He gets to contemplate corpses. We don't do that. We're delicate little Western psyches. We get depressed, but that's what he got. Yeah? Someone is bad-tempered, metabhavna. Yeah? We do that. We're all bad-tempered. And so on. Yeah? And our work can take many forms. Yeah, living out, bringing about the good can take many forms. On retreat last week, there was a guy whose work in the afternoon was just—he just took this upon himself. He's so busy and always doing things. It was to sit still on his own and do nothing. And you could see it was really hard work. That he was doing nothing is hard work. So bringing up healthy human beings with a sense of moral values—that is work for the good. Building a sangha through a Buddhist centre—that's work for the good. Counselling, policing, I'm going to try and think of everybody in this room. Town planning, healing, purifying the drinking water of the west of Scotland, education, teaching sign language, teaching computer logic. Yeah. All work for the good. But in a Buddhist community, in our community, there's a core, there's a heart to practice. There's a threefold path. You've got ethics. In our case, it's the five precepts, the ten precepts. You've got meditation, the fivefold system of meditation. You've got wisdom, or study and reflection, the basics of the Buddhism that you'll find in the Pali Canon, conditionality, the three marks, the four noble truths, eightfold path. You've got the writings of Sangharakshita. These are the heart of our practice, those three things. A lot of us are doing the Mitra course. Yeah, it's broad, it's comprehensive. It gives a thorough, systematic approach to understanding the Dharma. And then sustained. Yeah. In 27 years of Buddhist community, I've discovered that with myself and with most other people, if we're going to fall down in Buddhist practice, it'll be this. We don't manage to sustain it. We're very big in our society in initial enthusiasm. We're passionate in the moment, yeah, but we often fail to keep at it. Maybe because we're in a culture which has got lots of songs about falling in love, but very few songs about silver or golden wedding anniversaries. You notice that? Very few songs about how great it is 40 years on. Lots of songs about the first week, the first thrill, or even anticipating before the event, before you even got there. No end of songs about that. Work in the world requires keeping at it until the job is done. If you don't finish it, you don't get paid. Why should Buddhist practice be any different? And we've got opportunities in the Triratna community, in the Buddhist centre. We've got a Mitra course. It takes 4 years. Well, that's, in fact, the way we're doing it, it takes 6 years. Yeah? That is consistent practice. You turn up week after week, keep it going to the end, sustained. Yeah. Ordination process, it takes yonks. Yeah? It's thorough, systematic, every aspect of your life engaged. All dimensions you'll learn at Tiranta Loka, Padma Loka. Going in regular retreats. Yeah. There's plenty of chance to get beyond the phase of initial enthusiasm, to get beyond the pop song of teenage love. Yeah. It takes a certain thrawn approach. I love a Scottish word, thrawn. Yeah. A stubborn perseverance, which is like, I'll no be beaten, I'll show you. And Gordon Brown in the morning after the election, it's like, will he ever come out of there? He's like a badger in his lair. I'm not coming out. Here's some of the elders' verses on perseverance. There's lots of them. It's too hot, too late in the evening. People who say this, shirking their work, the moment passes them by. Whoever regards cold and heat as no more than grass, doing his manly duties, or womanly duties, I'll add that one in, won't fall away from ease. Stricken by sharp wind-like pains, you monk, living in a forest grove, harsh, with limited range for alms, what will you do? Suffusing my body with abundant rapture and joy, and enduring what's harsh, I'll stay in the grove. Developing the frames of reference, strengths, faculties, the factors of awakening, that's his system, I'll stay in the grove. Reflecting on those who are resolute, their persistence aroused, constantly firm in their effort, united in concord, I'll stay in the grove. Recollecting the one self-awakened, self-tamed and centred, untiring both day and night, I'll stay in the grove. And this one gets a prize. I'm blind, my eyes are destroyed, I've stumbled on a wilderness track. Even if I must crawl, I'll go on, but not with an evil companion. Even when our friends go off Buddhist practice, we stick at it. Here's Sati Matia. Formerly you had faith, today it is yours no more. What is yours only. No bad conduct is mine. For thus have I seen that faith, to be impermanent and wavering, even though people are interested, they become disinterested. Why should a sage waste away on that account? A sage's food is cooked a little here, a little there, in this family or that. I shall wander for my small alms. There is strength in my legs. I don't know if you've noticed, but life is hard work, whatever you do. It's not an option. Going forth is hard. Houses are hard places to live. The Dhamma is deep. Wealth, hard to obtain. It's hard to keep going with whatever we get. So it's right that we ponder continually, continual in constancy. And finally, freedom, bliss, beauty, the fruits of the path. This is the success part of the work. I've been struck by the positivity in these poems. You've got the tragedy, you've got the disgust with the futility of sensual life, the stubborn persistence. It could get you down, but there's this joy, this delight, this freedom. The path and the goal are unsurpassably joyful. Here's Kittika on meditation. How light my body, touched by abundant rapture and bliss, like a cotton tuft borne in the breeze, it seems to be floating, my body. They're full of contentment. There's a bliss of meditation and the unsurpassable joy of freedom. So I've got to bear this in mind with my gloomy tendency. I'll pick up on the negative bits of it, but I tend to be a bit like this lovely quote from Yeats. He must be talking about a fellow Irishman. He's saying, being Irish, he had an abiding sense of tragedy, which sustained him through temporary periods of joy. And being rural Scottish, it's much worse. But they're not gloomy texts. Yeah? They contain the most positive message possible. You can become enlightened, as Sumedha said to a would-be suitor, that poor chap with his elephants and his parasols. This is unaging. This is undying. This is the unaging, undying state, without grieving, without enmity, unobstructed, without stumbling, without fear, without burning. This undying has been attained by many, and this is to be attained even today by one who rightly applies themselves. And above all, it's the freedom and peace of Nibbana, the unbound state. Ways of taking birth are now known, devoid of essence, unstable, conditioned, always driven along. Knowing them as born from myself, mindful, I went straight to peace. The teacher has been waited on by me. The Buddha's teaching has been done. The heavy load has been put down. This powerful image of putting down a heavy load, to lay your burden down. It's like a line from these songs I've been listening to. So finally end with a couple of these. Mutta. A very grand one with a courtesan overcoming her despising of other women and all the things, but this is so domestic. So freed, so thoroughly freed am I from these three crooked things set free, from mortar, pestle, and crooked old husband. Having uprooted the craving that leads to becoming, I am set free from aging and death. And finally, my favourite. This is a verse that would be worth doing the whole retreat for, worth all coming here for a week just for these four lines. There's no name to the verse. There's a story of little Sturdy who's getting on with her work. She called it this little stocky woman who got on her work and was cooking dinner and it burnt. And she just stood there and looked at it and realised that everything was transient. And she went and joined the Buddha. And this verse, it's the Buddha's words to her that she remembered and she reflected on and she made it her own. And so when it came to her verse, her song, it was this. Sleep, little Terry. Sleep comfortably, wrapped in the robe that you made yourself. For your passion is still, like a pot of pickled greens, boiled dry.